According to our guest this hour, there are two serious health threats being managed right now. One is the Ebola virus. The other is fear of the Ebola virus. And of the two, he says fear is the far greater threat. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, October 29th. Do you fear the fear over Ebola? Do you think it's overblown, and why? And what should we do about it? Plus, what is this fear doing to our health? And why does our guest say the fear is a worse threat than the virus itself? What are your questions, concerns, or fears? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is David Ropeek, an instructor in the Environmental Management Program of the Harvard Extension School, a consultant in risk communication, and author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. His piece, Don't Fear Ebola, Fear Fear Itself, appeared in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists earlier this month. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot for being with us. So in your piece, you say that fear of the Ebola virus is a far greater threat than the Ebola virus itself. Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, the Ebola virus is awful, but it only spreads with direct contact with the vomit, diarrhea, or blood of a late-stage, very sick patient. Direct contact meaning your skin, a hole in your skin, on somebody like that. So that's not going to spread a lot. There are going to be sporadic cases, but in a system where we have healthcare like ours, we can contain those cases. The sparks don't become big fires. But the larger question is, what are the dangers of fear? And they are significant. I didn't used to know this, but after doing some reading on what chronic stress does, that's worry beyond the normal hassles of the day, that lasts more than a couple weeks, that raises our heart rate and blood pressure and contributes to elevated risk of cardiovascular disease. We saw this in people after the 911 attacks in New York City who had no experience with the attacks themselves, but the more freaked out they told people they were, the more likely they were to go to the hospital with cardiovascular problems.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic stress suppresses our immune system. It's doing things, chronic stress is like a fight or flight response. So it's doing things like, imagine the lions attacking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need to marshal all your resources to fight or flee or freeze, actually, is the third response. And you turn down the systems you don't need. Well, you don't have to worry about germs when your head's in a lion's mouth, right? So your immune system is suppressed. And if that lasts, you're more likely to catch an infectious disease, like, say, influenza, here comes flu season, or with a weakened immune system to get sicker or even die from a disease that maybe you could have fought off if your immune system's okay. And chronic stress does other things, too. Boy, it's powerfully associated with clinical depression. And suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in America. It interferes with neurotransmitters in our brain that are associated with mood. So there are lots of other reasons, and we have lots of time to discuss them, and I've gone on too long. But worrying persistently is really bad for our health, and Ebola is causing that sort of damage.
Well, why do you suppose we are worrying so much about the Ebola virus when it is not something that can be easily contracted?
Well, so this is a great question. So let's start at the beginning. We think we're smarter than we actually are. We think we're more rational than we actually are. Our brain uses a whole bunch of subconscious instincts and feeling sorts of factors that we're not really even in control of or aware of to do its main job, which when you wake up in the morning is to get you safely to bed at night. That's not thinking. That's kind of autonomic, emotional, reading the tea leaves. Could that be scary? Protective response. That keeps us alive. It's pretty cool. But it's not based solely on the facts. So with Ebola, we have a perfect demonstration of that phenomenon. This is, by the way, the research work of Paul Slovic in Oregon and Baruch Fischoff in Pittsburgh and other people. I'm just a journalist citing their work. Risk perception is an emotional thing, and there are characteristics to any given risk. that make it more or less scary. So let's go down those factors with Ebola. Ebola is new. We're not familiar with it. New makes things scarier. We just don't know how it's going to work out. Compare that, for example, to influenza. Bigger risk, but familiar. We know how that's going to work out, so it scares us less. Ebola kills us in a really nasty way. And the nastier a way to die it is, the scarier the risk is going to be. Regardless of the low odds, it'd be really nasty to happen.
Right.
Ebola feels like a disease we can't control. Right? Once you get it, fatality is over 50% in this outbreak and has been as high as 70% in other outbreaks, other different strains of the same disease, virus. And there's no vaccine against it. So if we don't feel like we can control a risk, any risk, that risk feels scarier. A risk is scarier the more it's on our radar screen. The academics like Daniel Kahneman and others call this the availability heuristic. They talk in academic language. But basically what they mean is the more a risk is on our radar screen, the more emotional weight it carries. Well, boy, 24/7 Ebola coverage and the fear goes up. And there's one final factor, and this is unfortunate, and I think the critics need to be challenged for their criticisms. The less we trust the people who are supposed to protect us, the heads of the healthcare system, you know, we can't protect ourselves from Ebola. We have to trust the system. And if we don't trust the people in charge of the system, our fear will go up. Well, along come the critics who say mistakes have been made, and that's true. That's absolutely true. And the critics should bring those to the public's attention. But they failed to point out that none of those mistakes suggested that the system doesn't know what it's doing, really clueless, right? Or that it lied on purpose, no. Or none of those mistakes actually put the public at risk. They were really riskier for healthcare workers, but not for you and me. And the critics don't point that out. They just drum on the, oh, mistakes have been made, and our trust in our leaders goes down, and the fear goes up. That's an awful lot of emotional baggage, huh?
Yeah. And then we have you know, stories in the news just this week about New York and New Jersey wanting to quarantine healthcare workers coming from West Africa. What impact does that have on public fear?
Wonderful question, Joy. And it feeds this, the healthcare, our healthcare leaders, the people in charge, even up at the governor's level, are winging it. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have their act together, right? So this was a fascinating story if you really dig into the details. This young heroic nurse who volunteered to go over and work on controlling Ebola in West Africa comes home, gets off the plane. She just came from Ebola land, all right? So obviously they're going to screen her. That's a good idea, right? They do a laser check of her forehead to take her temperature initially. It's 101.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Joy, what are you going to do? What am I going to do? We're going to say, step aside, young lady. We need to follow you, right?
Right, right.
Now, her later oral temperature, you know, the under the tongue thing, is normal. But now officials have two risks that they have to consider. One is, this lady is not symptomatic, so the scientific evidence says she can go to Maine, her home. But people are freaking out left and right. Suppose the word gets out that a woman who at one point had 101 fever and just got off the plane from Ebola land is out there traveling around. How would that go down? Oh, my God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't handle this well or consistently or argue their case clearly, and they didn't treat this woman very well who just came from the most traumatic time in her life watching people she was trying to save die in her hands. They put her in a cold tent and everything, and that blew up. And, you know, the critics who love to talk about politics more than policy said, oh, Cuomo wants to run and Christie wants to run. And all of the, you know, the New England Journal of Medicine people said, oh, my God, we're not going to be able to send healthcare workers to volunteer for Ebola, which is true. This would be a disincentive if they had to spend 21 days extra off their vacation time when they came back. But nobody was thinking in all of that about how America would feel if an Ebola land nurse with 101 when she first got off the plane was set free to travel. We have to quarantine against both the disease and the disease of fear, which, as I've described, has health effects too. And I think that's what these governors were thinking of. But I believe that this issue was handled badly by them and by the critics, and the confusion then feeds the mistrust that they are clueless about how to handle this.
We are talking with David Ropeek. He's an instructor in the Environmental Management Program of the Harvard Extension School. He is a consultant in risk communication, and he wrote a piece that we noticed that we thought you would like to talk about. Don't fear Ebola, fear fear itself, saying that the fear of the Ebola virus is more of a threat in the U.S. right now than the Ebola virus itself. We're talking about the health effects of fear. What are your fears? What are your thoughts and questions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So how do we allay people's concerns about Ebola? What do you think? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. According to our risk communication expert guest this hour, there are two serious threats being managed in the U.S. right now, the Ebola virus and the fear of the virus. And of the two, he says fear is the far greater threat. We are talking about the impact of this fear on our social and physical health. And we'll get into what must be done to overcome it. And we welcome your concerns. Do you think the fear is overblown when it comes to the Ebola virus, or do you think it's warranted? What are your concerns about the impact of Ebola or fear on the country? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. On Facebook, a listener posted a link to a humor article suggesting that Ebola misinformation was the fault of cable news. How has media coverage affected our fear of Ebola?
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. Remember how I talked earlier about the availability heuristic, and the more a boogeyman is on our radar screen, the more emotional weight it carries?
Yeah.
Well, bingo. The media are our radar screen on stuff that is happening outside our own personal life. Now, there are pros and cons to the coverage, and CNN gets picked on because they have this dramatic style. In fact, Andy Borowitz of The New Yorker ran a funny thing, a nation succumbs to fear of Wolf Blitzer.
Right.
Right, you know. Mm. But there's been a lot of very breathless, alarmist, oh my God sort of coverage because the news covers what is new, dramatic, and attention-getting. That's what they do. They're a business. And they serve the public, but not on purpose. They educate the public, but not on purpose. They inform the public for a living. And they want attention. I was a newsman for 22 years. I was one of these people. And you're going to pay attention, you and I, as viewers, to anything that might threaten your health. And you're going to pay particular attention to something that it kills you in a scary way, over which you have no control, that's new and unfamiliar, all those factors. Well, a news person senses those factors as opportunities to get more attention for their story. The things that scare us about a risk make them better news. So they get played up. And so they feed the fear. There's actually a research on this. It's called the social amplification of risk. Social amplification of risk,
mm-hmm.
By Nick Pidgeon and Roger Kasperson. And what they find is, exactly what I'm talking about, it's where I learned it from, when risk is amplified socially, and the media is one part of that, it creates new risks, like the risk from fear. Now, let's be fair. The media have repeatedly reported, I've seen it everywhere, that you only catch Ebola by getting a hole in your skin on these fluids. And let's also be fair. The media has been pretty regularly pointing out that we're overreacting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? My friend Seth Borenstein from AP had a great line the other day on one of his stories that went viral. He said, more people have married Kim Kardashian than caught Ebola in America. The problem is that Seth's story and those sidebars come after the breathless alarmism and the magnification of the criticisms that undermine trust in the system without any mention in the media or by the critics that these mistakes did not suggest the system has no clue or the mistakes were not a threat to the public. And yeah, they fuel the fears. It's part of the natural cycle of things. But my argument to my journalism friends and in the writing that I do is, you don't want to hurt people, and you are. When you overscare people, you hurt them. And think about that, please.
Yeah, let's here's a Peter on Facebook says, I'm more concerned about the poor government response. Ebola itself is manageable. Putting political hacks in charge of the CDC is worrisome.
Yeah, there you go. So that's exactly my point. So, Peter, you make a you represent a perfect example of what I'm saying. The person in charge of the CDC, Tom Frieden, is hardly a political hack. He's a brilliant, highly experienced medical officer. He's under the thumb of political hacks, if you want to call them hacks, the people that we have put in office to do things for us that we can't do for ourselves. That's what government is, right? Like, protect us. And when all of these stories about the mistakes that have been made come out, we go, wow, these political hacks have no clue. Let's look, at a couple of the mistakes, just to be specific about what I'm saying, though. So in Texas Presbyterian Hospital at first, when Mr. Duncan came in as the case zero in the United States, the hospital let him go home.
Right.
Oops. That's totally an oops. But Mr. Duncan went home to a family whom he lived with for a couple weeks before he got symptomatic and went back to the hospital. The family itself didn't get sick because Ebola doesn't spread this way. Nurses in the hospital weren't fully gowned and protected. These, by the way, were all the mistakes of the hospital. At this point, the CDC is not involved. The state of Texas isn't involved. The hospital has apologized for these things. We've learned from them. We learn from any new disease when it breaks out. Okay. Those mistakes put healthcare workers at greater risk, and two of them got Ebola, from which they've now recovered, thank God, but did not put the public at risk. We haven't heard that part of the mistake story. So the CDC gets a call from Amber Vinson in Cleveland. She's a Dallas nurse who's flown home to Cleveland, and she handled Mr. Duncan, and she has a low-grade fever. Can I get on the plane? And by the scientific description of, are you symptomatic, they said, yeah, you can get on the plane. And so she got on the plane and flew to Dallas, and it freaked everybody out. I mean, there are thousands of people in America now driving instead of flying because they don't want to get on a plane with an Ebola person, but that puts them at much greater risk. And there's the fear of fear again. Well, that risk didn't put the public at risk because she was not transmissible. It was a mistake, though, and the mistake got blown way up, should be reported for sure, but without those qualifications, and cumulatively that and the quarantine thing and this and that and the other thing, it makes it look like political hacks don't know what they're doing. When with those qualifications, a fair reporting on those mistakes might have helped me and Peter and everybody else say, well, you know, they're mistakes and they're screwing up and that's bad, but we're not all at risk because of them.
Let me get a caller in. We have full lines, by the way. Matt in Oshkosh is with us. Hello, Matt.
Yes, I feel that we should be erring on the side of caution. If this disease does get into a populated area like New York or Chicago, we are going to have serious problems. And if this is so difficult to transmit, why don't we have these people come to the White House immediately off the plane? Why don't we have these people come to your house, sir, and spend a little time? I don't think that the CDC or the medical community does fully understand all the ways that this disease is transmissible. I think there's plenty that is not understood about this disease. And then you want to just turn these people loose. I think if I were returning from Africa, I would feel so personally responsible. I would volunteer to spend the 21 days in quarantine to make sure that I was disease-free and also to make sure that if I did come down with the disease, I was in a place where I could be attended to properly.
We have just a little, only a couple of minutes before our news
that's
break.
That's a really good point, Matt. So first of all, what we know and don't know about Ebola. So Ebola has been around since 1976. There have been a lot of outbreaks. Fortunately, they stayed in small villages in West Africa where the people who contact each other didn't then go into town and spread them, like New York and stuff like you were talking about, Matt. So we know an awful lot. We do really know a lot about, the genetics of the virus. That's how we're confident to know that it doesn't spread in the air, right? That way, wow, we could all get it. I don't particularly understand your argument that people should go to the White House, but I think I do, or my house. I would agree with you that we need to err on the side of caution. As I was arguing earlier, the nurse who got off the plane in Newark Airport, while she did not have an oral temperature later, and the medical people are all saying she could go home, my argument is exactly yours, Matt, that being freaked out is a bad thing for our health, too, and we have to err on the side of caution, and that maybe having these people self-quarantine, as many have, doing exactly what you say, or now what the CDC is saying, if you're non-symptomatic, we'll let you go home, but we're going to check on your health every day, twice a day, for 21 days to stay on top of things. That is respecting the fact that we're all freaked out.
Let me hold you there, David. David Ropeek is our guest. We'll check news, and then we'll continue talking about the fear of Ebola. We are talking about the health risks of fear. Our guest is a risk communications expert who says right now we are at more risk because of the fear over the Ebola virus than we are with the virus itself. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, October 29th. So we welcome your questions and thoughts. Do you think there is too much fear over Ebola in the U.S.? Or do you think the fear is warranted? What does this fear do to us as individuals and as a society? And what do we do to quell this fear? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is David Ropeek, an instructor in the Environmental Management Program at the Harvard Extension School. He's a consultant in risk communication. He is the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. His piece, Don't Fear Ebola, Fear Fear Itself, appeared in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists earlier this month. We were talking with a caller just before news time who said, let us err on the side of caution, not trusting that the healthcare system knew exactly all it needed to know about Ebola. And you were saying, David?
Yeah, thanks. Sorry to bump up against the break and finishing a response to Matt. And in the news break, there was even mention of this. So President Obama said on his campaign trip through Wisconsin, or I think at the White House before he left, we should let science dictate how we isolate healthcare workers. The problem with that is, and I think the president's doing lots of good things, but some bad things too. And this is an example. If we just go with the science of how Ebola spreads, we're not responding, as Matt suggested, with an abundance of caution to people's fears. So that nurse gets off the plane and she has 101, later no temperature. Now what do we do with letting her go home? If she doesn't want to self-quarantine, as Matt suggested, and as many workers are doing, what do? Governor Christie, Governor Cuomo in New York have to figure out how do we handle the epidemic of fear. And that's not the science that the president was talking about. He's talking about the medical science. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's a limited view, in my opinion, of what the science tells us, because there's a science of risk perception that I describe in my book. And there's a definite science of chronic stress and economics and social impacts from fear. Well, schools have been closed and events are being closed. So I would agree with Matt that we have to err on the side of caution. Now, one quick addition, because I want to hear what more folks have to say, too. The president and a lot of other health leaders are doing a lot of things to respond to fear. The president promised to call out the National Guard. That's not going to be necessary. He appoints a czar. That's not necessary for the disease itself. The government is admitting mistakes. Apologizing. When was the last time anybody ever did that? The people in the hospitals, too, right? They're saying we're learning as we're going. There's a lot of policy response, throwing resources into this, honest, humble communications that are doing it on the good side, but I think more could be done to alert us to the dangers of worrying too much.
You know, the headline I'm seeing a lot these days in the media is, where's the Ebola czar? How come we haven't seen the Ebola czar do anything?
God, here's a great example of how this gets twisted by the media. So this guy, this person, I forget his name at the moment, was instantly criticized by Republicans, because that's, you know, the opposition party always does that to the other party, as being a political hack. And he was, you know, that he was from inside. He's like an organizer type guy. So as soon as there's criticism, he's going to lay low.
Yeah.
And besides, he's like the behind-the-scenes chief of staff organizer. That's all he's doing anyway, is a coordinator, right? And you don't want him as much as leaders who are in charge, the head of the CDC, Dr. Frieden, or the president, doing most of the talking. So we're not seeing him because it immediately got caught up into the noise of politics. And that noise of politics, and I'm not blaming one party or another, but the noise of politics makes us mistrust our leaders, which feeds the fear.
Yeah, we have another caller who wanted to say that the fear comes from our distrust of the healthcare system.
He had other
examples that I fear might kind of take us off topic. But is that do we distrust our healthcare system?
Well, whether we do or not is up to this caller's personal experiences or anybody's personal experiences. Mostly we trust the healthcare system, and in particular, surveys show, we trust our personal healthcare providers. And in fact, in my opinion, as a risk communication advisor, I think those are the people who really need to be doing the communicating. And if I were offering the government one suggestion, it would be that it would probably be out of the CDC or the Department of Health and Human Services. They should put out a message just describing the basic facts of how Ebola transmits and what the symptoms are and when to come to the doctor or not to doctors. Doctors don't have time to do all this communicating for us. They don't get compensated for it. They're busy people. But if the government helped them reach out to their individual patients as the most trusted people in this whole business, they would have a lot of influence on how people think, because we don't trust our politicians instead. So whether we trust them or not, yeah, I don't know. But it is extraordinarily important that we trust the people who are talking to us in terms of how much we end up worrying, as your email writer suggested. He doesn't trust. He fears more.
You know, clinics in Madison, and I assume all over Wisconsin, are asking people if they have traveled out of the country in the last 30 days, or whether they have a fever, or whether they may have had contact with somebody who has been in, you know, out of the country. Is that healthy or not healthy?
Well, I'm not a health expert. Yeah. I'm a risk perception guy.
Right, but is in terms of the but fear,
yeah,
of over
it
this.
Is, because it shows the caution that Matt was suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
It shows that they're ramping up their precautionary steps and they're learning new protocols, right? This Thomas Duncan guy flew in from Liberia. The best way is to keep these folks from flying in, right? And that's happening at all the airports where there's lots of Ebola. They're screened like crazy. Their temperature's taken. Where have you been? There's a whole long thing. Lots of people aren't being allowed to get on the plane. But Mr. Duncan wasn't symptomatic, and he lied about who he had been in contact with and gets on the plane. So now don't we want to ask them when they get off the plane? And as the CDC is doing, starting to suggest, at least with healthcare workers who have been there, and we know in contact with Ebola folks, monitoring their health for 21 days doesn't mean they have to be locked up. They're not symptomatic, but monitored. Yeah, I think that makes sense to help the public feel like our system is really respecting our fears and going out of its way to be safe.
Yeah.
I think that's helpful.
I went to the eye doctor on Monday and was asked that, and I knew why it was being asked, and it didn't bother me. Gary in Johnson Creek is with us. Hello, Gary.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Here's the question or the comment that I have, and it is essentially, I agree, there's a great deal known about this virus. It's been around, it's been studied a lot. But the virus emanates from an undeveloped part of the world, a part of the world where money isn't to be made from creating a vaccine. Had this virus emanated from a part of the developed world, I think a vaccine would have been created a long time ago.
Boy, Gary, you're so spot on. You're so spot on. And this is another part of risk perception. First, I mentioned these other risk perception characteristics that make a risk scary, but one of them, a big-time one, is we're scared more of risks that we think can happen to us than risks that happen to somebody else. We're not hurrying into vaccinating against a disease that's not a threat to us. That's part of the psychology of any risk. So as soon as one shows up in Dallas, whoa, it's here. Wow, now it's in New York. Whoa, it's here. Man, put one in Madison. You guys will freak out. It's here. It's here means it could happen to me. All the questions about can it mutate and spread in terms of respiration, breathing, that's, oh, my God, can it spread to where it could happen to me? That changes everything. And the reason your point is really important, Gary, is this. The more it spreads somewhere else in the world, a world that's really connected by airplanes, as Mr. Duncan taught us, the more it's going to get out, sparks, as Peter Sandman, another risk communication advisor, calls, that could land not in countries that have health care that can isolate the sporadic cases, but where, like in the undeveloped world where it's breaking out now, there is inadequate health care to do that, and it really starts to spread. And it affects economies like in India or Indonesia or some places like that, where the economic effects happen to us and where more people then can travel here. We're really connected, and we really have to consider that a risk that happens somewhere else is not just a risk to someone else, that it is a risk to us, and that will put it more on our radar screen.
Let's go to Barb in Green Bay next. Hello, Barb.
Hi, Joy. I just wanted to say that I think fear of the unknown is a danger to the health of our society as well as our physical health, because it's a primitive emotion, and it doesn't only cause a fight or flight response, but it also brings up other response, primitive responses such as prejudice, racism, hatred, violence, that type of thing.
Oh, Barb, awesome. Awesome. You guys are my teachers.
So smart, right? Yeah.
The fear of the unknown is a primitive fear, and what it does to our fight or flight response actually is it tells our brain to be more alert because we don't know what we need to know to protect ourselves. So that's why we have that fear response. Now, more than just the chronic stress effects of fear, you're absolutely right. We do other things to protect ourselves, like discriminate against people who just came from West Africa or are West Africans. In Minnesota, the largest Liberian population outside of Liberia is in Minneapolis. That's already happening. We treat people badly. Wow, this poor woman was throwing up on a plane the other day, just sick to her stomach, and they made her fly for half the flight in the bathroom. There are people coming back non-symptomatic who've been in Liberia who have important stories to tell, who had scheduled speeches but are being kept from making those speeches. There are events being canceled. Here's one. Nurse Hickox from the Newark airport was finally said you could go home, but stay inside when you get there. She's living with her boyfriend who's going to a little college in Maine. The students in the boyfriend's class said they're not going to come to school because they're freaked out by the boyfriend being there. Yeah, it has all kinds of social effects. And to point out, as I did earlier, those social effects actually lead to behaviors that can be risky. So if we're freaked out, we maybe have Ebola, what do? We go to the doctor or the hospital and expose ourselves to more infectious diseases. We don't fly, and we drive, and that raises our risk. We don't go to work. We don't buy things as much. That hurts the economy. We call for medical attention or the EMTs in the ambulances. Remember anthrax in 2001?
Right.
And that means that they have to spend more and can't do what they really need to do. You're absolutely right, Barb. It has all fear, has all sorts of tangible additional effects beyond just stress.
We are talking about fear of Ebola and how our guest says it's a bigger risk, a bigger health concern than the virus itself is in the United States. We're talking about what this fear does to us as individuals and as a society, where this fear comes from, and we'll talk more on how to overcome it in just a moment. And we welcome your thoughts and questions and concerns. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What concerns you more, the Ebola virus or the fear of the virus? What would you do to allay people's concerns about the Ebola virus? And who does this? Is it on us, the media, the government? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is David Ropeek. He is a risk communications expert. He is an instructor in the Environmental Management Program of the Harvard Extension School, author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the fear over Ebola and wondering if you think it's overblown and why, or what you think we should do about it, talking about what this fear is doing to our health. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We've had busy lines all hour long. Now we have an open line for you. As we talk with our guest, a communications risk expert, David Ropeek, who wrote a piece, Don't Fear Ebola, Fear Itself, which appeared recently in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So what is the vaccine for fear, David Ropeek?
Perfect way to wrap up. Thank you. The vaccine against fear starts with the fact that we understand that fear itself is dangerous. We take steps against danger all the time, right? You get in the car and you're driving into a dangerous environment, driving, you put on a seatbelt. So when you know you're going into a dangerous environment, you can take steps to protect yourself. You have to understand that being afraid itself, it's a good idea, right? You know, to protect ourselves and all, but it has risks. It's a risky environment to sort out a risk that you don't understand. As soon as you understand that, you realize, well, I better look around for protection, right? Now you're on the road to doing what you need to do, and that is pause a minute, just a minute. Don't go with your instincts because they're going to mostly be emotional, and you're validly entitled to your emotions, but they might lead to a dangerous excess of fear. Stop, think. You don't have to think hard. Just get a couple more facts. How does it spread? That's a pretty easy one with an Ebola, right? So all those other criticisms and flaws notwithstanding, how does it spread? Because as soon as you think about that with this disease, you don't have to worry as much. But you have to stop and think, and to do that takes mental effort, and we mostly don't do that instinctively. So to get to that level, recognize that fear itself could be worse for your health than the disease. And now you can read my book, which explains why fear happens, or just pause, get more information about the risk at hand, and let the facts have a little bit more say.
Yeah, so it's up to us to vaccinate ourselves?
Really, come on. You know, what are we going to do? Say to the government or the media or anybody that it's their responsibility wholly? No, it's really ours to sort risks out as intelligently as we can. None of us are experts, but mostly we go with our instincts, and that can get us into trouble. Yeah, it is our responsibility to use a little bit more facts to balance out the emotions. You're still going to have the emotions, but balance them out with a little careful thinking. And, yeah, protect ourselves. Ultimately, it's up to us to protect ourselves. Yes.
Let's go to Dan in La Crescent. Hello, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, why stop the quarantine at 21 days? I mean, that's a number that came from science. And if we're not going to trust the science that we know, why stop there? Why not do the quarantine for 2 years? You know, out of an abundance of caution. You know, err on the side of caution. And if that's the case, too, you know, maybe the devil is the cause of this. So everybody under quarantine should start saying prayers, and prayers of all denomination, Muslim, Christian, whatever. You know, why not a rabbit's foot? I mean, you understand I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Dan. With time short, let me just butt in with a little bit of an answer. At some point, you have to go with what you know and the facts and the science. And that was what I was saying, that our emotions can carry us way too far, right? Quarantine for 2 years and rabbit's feet. So you do have to go with the science, which President Obama said, that our policies have to be science-based, right? 21 days is, from long experience, the extended period after which, if you have been exposed and you don't get it, the virus isn't going to break out in you. That's a pretty confident one. How it physically spreads is a pretty confident one. My argument is that in addition to that, though, Dan, the science of what fear does to us means that fear has to be managed, too, because it's a real physical health risk. In fact, spreads easier than Ebola. It's more impervious to treatment than Ebola. You know, it's pretty thorny, and it can do us more harm. So we do have to look to the science of risk perception, why we fear things too much, or in other cases, too little. That's what I wrote about in my book. And we do have to remember as risk managers, personal and government, that we have to manage the health effects of fear, too, with the sciences of what we know about that as well.
We had a caller who I think did biofeedback and did things to lower her blood pressure and to reduce her stress, yoga, that sort of thing. Is that something we should do?
Well, sure. That's, you know what that's doing? That's getting past the initial emotional how does it feel way that most of us use, myself included, to sort stuff out. She's giving her breathing more time. She's slowing down her, you know, brain activity and all. Biofeedback is also physically healthy for you. But it's what I'm talking about, which is doing something to get beyond just the emotional way of reacting to it and giving the facts a little bit more time to have a say. All of those sorts of things are helpful for us to stay safe from fear.
And in just our final minute, don't have time for a caller who just wants to point out that, you know, the flu is more dangerous to people than Ebola is in this country. Get a flu shot, maybe?
And I just got mine, as a matter of fact, and I bet this Ebola thing will show up in two ways this year. As I said in my bulletin piece, I bet the flu season is going to be worse because worried people have suppressed immune systems. That means more people are going to get the flu or be sicker from it. But I also bet that the lines are going to be longer for people to worry about the flu and get in line. And there's a lesson, too, right? Why don't we do that all the time? Flu's out there every year. It kills directly 1,500 people and indirectly between 3,000 and 49,000. Why? Because it's not new. It's familiar. And we do feel like we have control.
Yeah.
We only get in line for flu shots if we think there's something unusual, new, right, a new strain of flu, or there's going to be a shortage of the vaccine and we lose control. And these emotional factors work against our worrying about flu as much as we should.
And we're going to leave it there. This has been great. Thank you so much, David Ropeek, for being with us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.